Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to The Powerful Patient. We're delighted to have you with us today. And today we're going to talk about a very interesting topic, Tai Chi, a practice that originated in China, but can be used for by just about everybody. And we have two physicians today to talk with us about that and really give us an idea of how Tai Chi might fit into your own life and what benefits you might reap from it. So whatever your medical challenges may be, it's something to think about, and hopefully we'll have a stimulating discussion. I'd like to remind everybody that we are taking questions on the air, so you're welcome to either put your questions into the chat line at Blog Talk Radio, or if you want to dial in and ask your question live on the air, you're welcome to do that too. The telephone number is posted at Blog Talk Radio, and it's 347-237-4... Forget the last part of it. I don't have it in front of me. 4368, I think it is. I'll repeat it after the ad. But right now, I'd like to play you a little ad about von Hippel-Lindau disease. My primary community is people with von Hippel-Lindau disease, a hereditary cancer syndrome. So let's hear a little message from our sponsor, and we'll be back in 1 minute to talk with our guests.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back, and the telephone number to dial, I did get it wrong before, the telephone number to dial to ask your question on the air is 347-237-4358. And we have today with us Dr. Zubin Guo from the University of Tennessee. Welcome, Dr. Guo.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Dr. Peter Wayne from Harvard University.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Great. It's great to have you both with us, and I think you bring two different but complementary aspects of the question with you today. It should be really interesting to talk about. So, Dr. Wayne, could we start with, I've heard Tai Chi described as meditation in motion, and the word meditation sometimes puts a number of people off because they think there's some religious practice about it. Oh, tell us what your perspective is on the word meditation.
Well, that's a great question. There are many aspects to meditation. One of them that's very simple and doesn't have any spiritual connotation is just being more aware of what's happening in your body and in your local environment. So another word is awareness or presence. So that's one aspect of that. And we know from a good bit of research, just having people focus on their breath or focusing on body scans can have huge physiological effects, which then feed back to very positive aspects of health. So that's
right. So we're talking primarily about meditation as a way of being conscious of what's going on in your body and sort of listening to your body. Is that right?
I think that's one important component. In Tai Chi, and Dr. Guo can speak to this as well, there are many other pieces of the meditation. There is the meditation that includes more active imagery or visualization. So as we practice these, we may use some of the metaphors from the Tai Chi classics about flowing like water or being rooted like a tree or having some more optimistic intentions and trying to breathe in healing energies from nature or things like that, all of which sound a little bit new agey. But as we're learning in our research, what we believe really has a huge impact on our physiology and how we feel. And that's also substantiated by a lot of the placebo research, too.
Right. Well, you said New Age, but in fact, this practice is not new at all. It's really quite ancient, isn't it, Dr. Guo?
Yes, and the exercise itself is very ancient and old. And I think the Eastern wisdoms of healings and able to become popular in America and in the West. And I think that is a lot of scholars that describe it as new phenomena. And I think especially Tai Chi become popular, I think, after the 70s and 80s because of the desire of looking for alternatives.
Right. And I live in Brookline, Massachusetts, which has a fairly large Chinese population. And in the morning in the parks, you always see at least a few people out in the park, in the green space, doing Tai Chi movements. And I noticed when I was in China, when you go to a park in the morning in China, you will see literally hundreds of people standing out there as if they were going to do calisthenics, but instead doing these very graceful movements of Tai Chi together in the park. Is there something about doing it outside, doing it, as you say, in that context of nature?
Yes, I think and of course, China has always been a traditionally agricultural society, which is that the dealing with nature is always very important in life. So get up in the morning and is seen as the most healthy and thing, and because morning and presents a fresh and energy and in terms of yin and yang. Good energy or bad energy. So morning is always perceived the golden time to inherit this powerful and purified energy and enhance yourself. So doing exercise in the morning is always considered the proper way of maintaining good health. That's why and throughout China, and you're right, and every park and in the morning, winter or summer, and filled with people. And dancing, doing Tai Chi, all kinds of stuff because that that factor.
I too have been to China and I was so impressed by seeing not even hundreds but tens of thousands of people in parks in the morning. And I just want to add two things to that. One is that I think when we start our day with the right intentions and we've slept and our body is sort of has recouped its energy, it's a really nice time to set the tone for the rest of the day. So I think that's one of the nice reasons. Having said that, and like Dr. Guo, having worked with various populations that may not have access to a park early in the morning, some of my teachers joke and say, do it any time of the day as long as you do it. And,
right.
So we work with people in hospitals. We work with people who don't have the facility or the ability to get to a place in nature. And it's not essential. Sometimes in the practices, we can even use imagination to bring nature in. But while it might be nice to do it at a certain time in a certain place, that by no means should be something that excludes other people who can't get there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So a lot of people think when you get up in the morning and you do your exercises that you're doing like push-ups and calisthenics and vigorous movements and that kind of thing. So, but Tai Chi is different from that. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of movement that are involved in Tai Chi?
Well, and Tai Chi is really what's called a healing arts and the martial arts all together. And the whole idea behind Tai Chi is about the movement of energy, and which is a very fundamental idea in Chinese medicine, that one's health is determined by the quality and the quantity of the energy. So one way to promote the circulation of good energy is, or accumulating the amount of good energy, is by properly moving your body. And Tai Chi is considered as one of the effective methods to effectively move your energy in a very gentle way. And of course, there are a lot of people also doing martial arts, hard martial arts, internal martial arts. But Tai Chi is considered as internal martial arts, which means that somehow that exercise will cultivate a powerful, not just a body, but a mind as well. So that exercise become ideal for people who are not interested or are not able to perform vigorous physical activities. And so, for example, elderly, and they become Tai Chi become very popular among that population as well. So
in Chinese medicine, there is this concept of qi, which, as you say, is an energy. It's like there's a blood system and a lymph system. In Chinese medicine, there's also this qi system, which I conceptualize
right.
as your kind of electrical system, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not
mm-hmm.
something you can see or put your finger on, but there's a very real flow of energy in our bodies that in Chinese medicine is extremely important, and when you have a surgery, for example, it sometimes cuts across some of these normal flows of energy, and you have to kind of put it back together somehow.
Right.
Can I expand on that?
I think that's a good point. I think bringing the idea of energy in is not very easily adaptive to the Western model of the physical body, which is more like a machine with parts that all interact. Chinese medicine and Tai Chi, which grows out of that, and the whole philosophy is much more holistic. And in that sense, what I think Dr. Guo was emphasizing is that it's not just the movement. As you said, some people wake up and do their calisthenics, their push-ups. But when people do Tai Chi, we think of it as a mind-body exercise, as a meditation, a moving meditation. So in that sense, we're doing things that have calisthenic components. We're shifting our weight from side to side if we can stand, or moving our spine if we're sitting. We're moving our limbs, and there we're stretching and creating improved circulation and range of motion, like many other Western exercises. But while we're doing that, we're aware of how we're breathing. We're aware of where our attention is. Unlike Western calisthenics, which is interesting, people get on the treadmill and watch CNN. That is a way to help them, you know, stay on the treadmill, but it's a very different approach to Tai Chi, where if you were on a treadmill, it'd be really interesting to notice how your feet feel and to notice how you're breathing and to sense parts of your body and how they're moving. So with that internal awareness, you may start to notice how things are flowing and not flowing and become more aware of, you know, what we would just colloquially say, you know, how's your energy level? And in terms of science, people are beginning to study these aspects of what you said, Joyce, is the electrical system. And here at the Harvard Medical School, we have our colleagues that, in the context of acupuncture, are starting to ask whether acupuncture points and what we call the channels of acupuncture, the meridian, have different bioelectric and anatomical properties than other parts of the body. And some of the evidence is starting to suggest that there may be some tools from Western science that can really validate and help inform that energy model.
Right. Now, you're involved in the mind-body research program at Harvard University, isn't that right, Dr. Wayne?
Yes, that's right. I'm the director of the Tai Chi and mind-body research program at the Harvard Medical School.
So what is the mind-body research program about?
We have a fantastic group of physicians, of researchers, of people who have expertise in these practices that get together. And we work with all branches of the hospitals here to do basic research. We do clinical research in many conditions. For example, we have a number of trials studying how Tai Chi and related practices can benefit people with chronic heart failure, other studies with people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. We're working with more mechanical issues or musculoskeletal issues, such as women with low bone density, people with balance problems. So we study, much like you would in a drug trial, whether a course of Tai Chi can improve the symptoms and the underlying causes of these conditions, as well as trying to understand the mechanisms. What is going on that these very simple movements in some ways can have such profound physiological effects as we're seeing?
Yeah, we're used to thinking in terms of mind over matter or something like that, but how can your mind affect your low bone density?
Well, in the case of low bone density, there may be some ways that that loop can happen directly. In the case of bone density, we're very interested in Tai Chi as a weight-bearing exercise. We know that walking may be as beneficial as weight training in terms of slowing the rate of bone loss in postmenopausal women. The research suggests that. So Tai Chi certainly has that potential amount of weight-bearing pressure. But because we learn to stand with very relaxed muscles in Tai Chi, we're not bracing, we find good balance, that for a given amount of standing and pressure, the bones may actually take on more weight. There's some preliminary studies done in China as well in the West that suggest that people who do Tai Chi have better bone health. Those need to be supported by the research that we and others are now doing. So there's a physical piece to it. The other piece that's key is that low bone density is particularly an issue if you fall because you're at risk for a fracture. And we have good evidence from lots of studies to show that Tai Chi can improve balance. So that's a second way. The mind piece hasn't been fully explored, but we know from some studies that when people experience long periods of stress, their endocrine system starts producing stress hormones such as cortisol, and those have negative impacts on bone density, much like someone taking corticosteroids. Whether Tai Chi can influence that system significantly, we don't know, but those are some of the things we're looking at as well.
Very interesting. So if we're looking at Tai Chi, which is this very ancient practice, and suddenly realizing that with Western medicine, we can take a look at some of the physiological changes that are affected by using a practice like Tai Chi on a regular basis. Did I capture that or not?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And Dr. Guo, you're taking a slightly different look at it. I noticed you're a neuromedical anthropologist. What is a neuromedical anthropologist anyway?
A medical anthropologist, I'm sorry. And medical anthropology is a study of human health related behaviors, beliefs and systems from cross-cultural perspective. And to understand why we have such perceptions about disease and about health, oftentimes we have a concept, social cultural construction of disease and health. Is that what do we mean by health? What do we mean by sicknesses? What do we mean by pain? And all those concepts, of course, from biological perspective, there are, and some sort of hopefully some sort of universal explanations or definitions, but from our perspective, cultural anthropology perspective, it's very difficult to establish a universal definition because each of our behavior and the beliefs are specifically designed, created, associated with our own ecological social condition. So that is the basic premises of medical anthropology.
So people who grew up in a different culture may have a different attitude toward some of the changes we experience in life, like aging, for example, right?
Absolutely.
So some people say, you're aging, you're 70, you don't walk the same way you used to. Other cultures may say, oh, this is a problem and you need corrective surgery or something.
Right. And when I was at at Harvard and we studied the Alzheimer's and cross-culturally, the good thing about that is that I learned so much is that not every culture and define, identify, recognize the symptoms of Alzheimer's or dementia same way as we do. In many cultures, especially in the developing societies and where the extended family structure is pretty very prevalent, and many people don't recognize those symptoms, for example, forgiveness or forgetfulness, and you get lost in the community in the village as a problem. And rather than here, and we do see as a problem. Now, the reason we see a problem, because there are consequences. We can't really let our, grandparents or parents and over 70, 80 years old and can't remember when it's next appointment, cannot, make the checkbook and cannot find a home and even forgot to turn the stove off. That is very, very dangerous. So that's why there is, I think, more of a desire for us to deal with the problems than, say, in agricultural society.
Right. So if grandma's sitting by the fire in a village with three generations of people in the same household, and maybe if she wanders off, one of the neighbors just brings her back, so that
right.
it's not the same kind of a problem as it would be here if she went out into traffic.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Interesting. So we have different perspectives on things. But I noticed that you got involved with Tai Chi, not only for people who have all their faculties, but also for some people who have some physical limitations. Can you tell us about how you got involved in that?
Well, and I'm always interested in how to modify Tai Chi to help with people with disability. I think one of the great story that I often tell people why I started this is that one day I got a phone call from a friend, from actually a person who asking me to teach him Tai Chi at a private level. And so after we all agreed, and then at the end of the conversation, he said, by the way, I am blind. I cannot see. Do you have any problem? Of course, and at the moment, I was really, really shocked, and the first time for me and to teach somebody at Tai Chi and who cannot see. But I agreed. So he tell me how to get his house. I went to his house, and his door was open. And he is a writer and, working in his basement. So he asked me to go to his basement and just, let him know. So I opened the basement door. I saw nothing but pitch black. So I yelled, I said, Paul, and I'm here. Where is the light switch? And he said, what do we need light for? And that incident, that was back in 86. And changed my way of thinking about disability, and I am disabled. And if in the right circumstances, then I began to think about, well, it'll be wonderful if we can create some kind of Tai Chi that be good for people and cannot see or cannot walk. But over the years and being pay attention to working with people who has ambulatory difficulties. 2005, and after China was awarded with the Olympic hosting as a hosting country, I contacted the Chinese Paralympic Committee and says I'd like to promote the virtual Tai Chi program I developed. And they reviewed the program, and they liked it, and everything started pretty smoothly. And in 86, they hosted the first national virtual Tai Chi instructor workshop. And so after that, and the instructor went back, and they just found out people love the virtual Tai Chi for several reasons. I think one of the reasons is that many of those activities that people do, people with disability, oftentimes reinforce the negative concept they are disabled. And the activities specially designed and sometimes repetitive, sometimes not terribly exciting. But Tai Chi for them is something that, people able to Tai Chi always consider as those people are mind and body altogether, trying to cultivate the mind by normal people.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, the able to Tai Chi really normalize, empowering them. And I think ever since 2007, and the virtual Tai Chi become very popular, was included in the Olympic Culture Festival and last year as well.
Right. So it's important that we move as much as we can move. And, if the legs don't work, the arms still work. So we need to make sure we're moving them in order to have sufficient breath and upper body strength and things like that. So it's really good to have any kind of a movement exercise. And Tai Chi has some particular benefits. What particular benefits would you point to in Tai Chi for someone with a physical disability? Dr. Wayne, you want to take that one?
Well, I think that just sticking with people who may be limited in their movement and may be constrained to a wheelchair, obviously all the upper body movements are great, as you and Dr. Guo have mentioned. They improve circulation. They improve lymph movement. We know that any kind of exercise has very important feedbacks on mood and quality of life. And as Dr. Guo said earlier, you know, self-efficacy, the feeling that that this isn't a limitation, but it's an opportunity to use your body to its fullest potential. But I also think that as a mind-body exercise, even if people have no potential to move or very limited potential to move their limbs, their upper limbs, or, for example, quadriplegic, just the meditative aspects of it, the imagination of the movement can be helpful. The breathing, the relaxation are helpful. There's some nice research in the stroke literature where people who have paralysis in one side of their body or both, as they're learning to try to regain function, sometimes just watching other people doing it and imagining their bodies doing it sets the learning process up so that people gain those functions back in a more efficient way. So using just the mind in those cases without physically moving can have some therapeutic effects. And one of my Tai Chi teachers sometimes will visit his students who may be bedbound in the hospital and will actually do Tai Chi in their room. And they can participate by watching and sort of intuiting the qualities of that, doing the breathing with them. So I think that there are many, many benefits that can happen regardless of physical limitations.
Right. And besides the physical benefits, there are some emotional and mental benefits too, Dr. Guo. You mentioned it changes the way people look at their wheelchairs.
Yes, and especially when you know, look at literatures, and there are a great deal of effort put into creating activities for people with disability, especially ambulatory disabilities. But however, the inactivity still remains a huge concern for that population. And study found that a host of factors contributing to the inactivities. For example, transportation and accessibility to the equipment facilities and affordability and to those health programs and fitness programs. And so many of these individuals want to exercise and get into some kind of health program, but because of those difficulties, they cannot. So Tai Chi, I think, provides some kind of alternative for those people, and it does not require any kind of transportation. You can do at home, anywhere, and in the chair or not in the chair, and any time. So that has itself and creates some kind of self-confidence. One of the students who participated in Sisson Hospital last year, and she involved in an accident 5 years ago and paralyzed from hip down. And she said, "Now I don't feel free anymore. I know I can't do Tai Chi anywhere." And so that is something that I found is very significant for that population. And they have very little choice in terms of physical activities. And to able to identify activity like such as Tai Chi as something they can do easily and they can do any time without limitation of any external factor itself is very comforting and increase self-confidence. Another thing about Tai Chi is that Tai Chi movement is circular, different from other movement. The circular movement somehow, and according to my interview with a lot of wheelchair Tai Chi participants in China, creating space for them. They feel they can move much, much bigger, and they can move much, much more. Instead of, you know, from A to B, they can circular, and their body movement nonstop. That creating a lot of mental power and as well. And so I think all those, you know, plus Dr. Wen just indicated all those medical benefits, psychological benefits is tremendously important for the population as well.
So tell us more about circular movement. So as you move your arms in a circle or you move your body in a circle?
Of course, and the first you will see the arms in a circular movement. Imagine that people in a wheelchair, for example, and when they try to reach out, right, there is always the limitation is immediately, it's right there. And if you reach too far, they have to either fall, right, or have somebody else help them. So their movement, physical movement, is very, very limited in that way, left or right and back and front. But the Tai Chi movement is not straight line from A to B, straight. Rather, that is circular. So that creates you can non-stop moving your arm, moving, when you say body, it's really the body, of course, and create a small circle and arms moving big circle, but create a kind of a movement. There is no end. There's no stop point.
Interesting. Yeah, and as you were talking, I was thinking about your blind student.
Mm-hmm.
Teaching Tai Chi to a blind person is a little like teaching it on the radio. You know, we don't have the visual element here, but we do have the audio. And I was once at a conference with some people who were blind, and in the middle of the conference, the power went out. And we were in a big auditorium that had no windows or anything, you know, so it was pitch dark, and all of us were sort of stunned, and we're sitting there in silence, and all of a sudden this one small voice called out to one of the blind men in the room and said, "Abe, get me out of here." She knew that he would be able to get out. So as you said, you know, who has the limitations, and where are the limitations, and do we create some of these in our own minds, and is there a way to bridge that and help us see beyond the limitations to the possibilities?
Exactly.
I'd be very curious to hear Dr. Guo describe a little bit to us and your listening audience what some typical exercises look like for people in wheelchairs that that draw from the Tai Chi principles.
I mean, in China or here?
Either one. I know that you teach people in wheelchairs, and I think people are familiar with some of the typical movements you see people do in the parks or in classes, but I'm wondering if you can just sketch a little picture in our minds for the radio audience what a typical class might look like, what kind of movements people do.
Oh, I see. The form and I design is 13 movements and in commemorating the 13th Paralympic game and that's last year. And
The 13 what? The 13 basic movements that are similar to
commemorating the 13th Paralympic Games. Last year, 2008, Beijing.
The 13 Olympic Games. Go ahead.
Yes, Paralympics, not Olympics. Paralympics Games.
Paralympic Games.
Yeah.
Okay.
So all the 13 movements are really selected based on the characteristics of people in the wheelchair and what kind of move was the best for them. And the considerations was that the movement would create the vertical and horizontal circle. And also the movement incorporate with the turning and moving the wheelchair. And rather than just sit there and doing Tai Chi, and you actually cheer moving with the movement. And so that way really create kind of empowerment to the people who are doing the wheelchair. And also for the audience, when they see that, they feel inspired and they feel, you know, the chair is no longer just a wheelchair, it's some kind of a tool, of a weapon. And so when especially the group people are demonstrating and the wheelchair Tai Chi is very, very moving and very, very powerful. And when the people, 50 people demonstrated last year at the day before the opening ceremony of Paralympics, and they had a great festival. And when they demonstrate, a lot of the people, audience, or normal who can walk, and we are, and very inspired. And these, we never thought that those people can move so beautifully. And so the movement is very, very beautiful and powerful. And when you're doing the at the group, especially when you have the chair moving with the moves all together. And so those are the major considerations when we design this form, is make sure the percent of power and also and give audience some kind of uplifting and energy. Now, when people practice themselves and those 13 moves, and you can actually practice use two methods, and you don't have to move in chair with you. We can just sit there and doing all the 13 moves. Or you can move in the chair with you if the space allows. So there are various ways of practicing and this form. I don't know if that answers Dr. Wayne's question, or is that what?
No, I think that's fabulous. And I know that you have some clips from the Olympics and from other places on the internet as well that demonstrate some of these movements. Is that right?
Yes, yes, and we have made several video clips, and including 2007 the Olympic Culture Festival demonstration, and 2008 on the website and YouTube, and I don't remember that.
Okay, well, we'll put it in the handout. There'll be a handout with the show at powerfulpatient.org. If you'll go to our website at powerfulpatient.org, we will have the pointers to Dr. Guo's videos so that you can see them. So when you do Tai Chi regularly, there's a movement that goes from the foot up through your body, out your head, to your arm, something like that?
Yeah, there's a phrase in the classics that really speaks to how Tai Chi integrates the body, both physically and mentally. But in a physical sense, they say that the movements start in the ground, are steered by the waist, and administered by the hands. So that speaks to how the bottom and the top integrate. But it also goes the same if you are, let's say, playing with a friend. And in Tai Chi, we have two-person exercises to explore the principles as a interactive exercise or martial art. When someone will push on your hands, it goes the other way. You would feel and receive that stimulus in the hands, and then it would be sensed by the rest of the body and integrated to whatever your ground is. In the case of a seated exercise, what you're sitting on, your sits bones or wherever your contact is your ground. I would imagine that the biomechanics of that are a little bit different, but the principles will be no different whatsoever for someone who is ambulatory and standing versus someone that's seated. And there's some great, fun kung fu movies where, some of the fighting scenes are done by people sitting down. So one can practice their skills that way as well.
Uh-huh.
If I may, well said, Dr. Wayne. And there's another very, very interesting component and come with that form of exercise. That's what I learned through promoting wheelchair tai chi in China. And 2007, when I went to China, and there are a lot of people come to me and say, "Well, you saved my life." I said, "What happened?" He said, "Well, this exercise is incredibly powerful." I was completely shocked and to hear the story. Actually, pretty simple. And the wheelchair tai chi and those movements, just by participate every day, solve the some of their constipation problem.
Yes.
And so I think that is the pretty common symptoms among people who rely on wheelchair, and which there's hip up, there's no movement. And like Dr. Wing said, Tai Chi is really talking about the try to generate a force from a root, from the feet. So when you sit in the wheelchair, your leg, your low back become your feet. So by focusing on your low back and to generate movement through body and to your arms, and really create some kind of simple therapeutic massage effect to your internal organ, which help to solve those problems.
Right, and I think we hear about digestive complaints a lot, not just in people in wheelchair, but people who have a sedentary lifestyle or who may be in the hospital for a while. As you say, the digestive system depends to a certain amount on the movement of the muscles around the bowel, and if the muscles around the bowel are not moving, then the bowel gets lazy and so forth. So what other kinds of digestive complaints have you seen that benefit from a practice of Tai Chi?
Well, I think your point is a really important one. There's movement and no pun intended, but then there's bowel movement. But some of it is the physical movement, but some of it is the shape of the body in that area. If the pelvis is continuously closed and there's a significant sway in the lower back, that does not give the proper blood flow and environment for the intestines to function well. So in evolutionary biology, we talk about form and function. And you can picture this for the lungs much easier if you see someone with a very stooped posture with their head down and their shoulders drawn forward and a very collapsed shape. Obviously, their lungs are not going to have as great a function as if their head is upright and their rib cage is open. But the same is for the intestines. And one thing that's not as obvious until you hear this, until you start to think about it, is it's not just the physical movement, but breathing becomes very important in these practices. And I was just fortunate enough to hear one of my colleagues, Dr. Helen Langevin, give a keynote talk at the North American Conference in Integrative Medicine. And she talked about putting things together. And she showed a map of the body, an anatomical map, and she showed that the lungs actually sit basically very in close proximity to the top of the intestines. And every time you breathe, you change your internal air pressure and you massage your intestines. And one would think that people have begun to study the effects of breathing patterns and breathing disorders on intestinal function, but there are very few collaborations between pulmonary departments and GI departments. And her point was that this is such an obvious thing from someone who does these practices. Every time you breathe, there is impact there. There's neural stimulation, there's physical stimulation, there's probably a neuroendocrine relations, but no one studies these obvious connections because we're all focusing on, oh, we don't do lungs, we do intestines, we don't do intestines, we do lungs.
Right.
And so the spirit of Tai Chi as a holistic exercise, as a whole mind-body, as how do we connect the parts and make them function as a whole, is just becoming a more interesting area of focus for Western research. And there are some recent studies on meditation and breathing exercises for irritable bowel syndrome and for other chronic gastrointestinal issues. There are not that many that I know of specifically for Tai Chi, but I think as Dr. Guo and I have emphasized, Tai Chi really includes many components of meditation and other mind-body exercises like yoga, like breathing, so that some of the research in those areas are probably relevant to Tai Chi as well.
Well put.
I sometimes talk with patients about breathing, and they go, come on, I know how to breathe, but I think we forget how to breathe sometimes, especially if we're under a lot of tension, if we're depressed, we're under a lot of stress, we tend to breathe more shallowly, and we don't realize the impact of that. Somebody want to take that one and talk about the impact of shallow breathing and why it's important to breathe more deeply?
Well, I think one of the very common observations of people who become angry and who become emotionally unstable, you see them breathing get shallow and rapid. And when you relax, then your breathing tend to be longer and deeper. And I think that breathing is a reflection of your physiological conditions and also reinforce that physiological condition. I think that's why, breathing has become a very, very important element in Chinese healing. It's qigong or tai chi, all requires of deeper and abdominal breathing, because that kind of breathing is said to associate with cultivating calm mind rather than the rush mind. If you're breathing quickly and for 5 minutes, you will realize that everything is almost like you are about to go to war, and that excitement can build up quickly. But if you're breathing slowly, that somehow will change the psychological and physiological process. And so that is why I think that Tai Chi is so emphasized on the breathing, because breathing is part of the movement and can reinforce the movement, effective movement, but also and can reflect the quality of your movement.
Now, I think that's very well put. Can I add a few things to, that? I think, as Dr. Guo said, a very common example of how breathing impacts emotion and how emotion impacts breathing is to watch a young child get upset. And I have a little boy, and if they're having a moment where things aren't going quite well, you can see that that emotion immediately impacts the breathing. What's interesting as a tool of meditation is the corollary, as Dr. Guo said, is true. If we can have that child, and sometimes we'll say, take a breath, you know, catch your breath. Mm-hmm. But if we can start to regulate the breathing a little bit, it starts to give access to that physiology of emotion. And we know now from a number of sound studies that slowing and deepening your breathing in and of itself has huge impacts on the autonomic nervous system. The balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and it tends to strengthen the latter, the one that calms us down from that fight-or-flight response.
Right.
And we know that that sympathetic overdrive, as it might be, underlies a lot of chronic conditions, including cardiovascular disease conditions, pulmonary diseases like COPD, and can really set the body into a long-term chronic stress. So just that piece is important, and just slowing the breath down and deepening the breath, and maybe adding a little mindfulness to that so you're following your breath. If you're doing that, not only are you changing your physiology, but if you're staying with your breath, there's so many other things that you can't be thinking about, which often is what gets us into trouble, worrying about things, about what might happen later or future.
My first introduction to this was when I had a baby in 1971. I took Lamaze classes,
right.
And I learned Lamaze breathing, and which is helping women in labor to take their mind to the beach, your mind someplace else that you'd rather be right now, and calm your spirit and calm your body. And one of the phrases they say is to sort of get out of the way of your body, let your body do its thing, and take your mind elsewhere. So that you can relax yourself. And then in 1986, when my son was going to have surgery, I took him to the mind-body clinic at Harvard University and asked them to work with him to learn how to do that kind of breathing to manage post-surgical pain. And there was some research even then, and I'm sure you know more, Dr. Wayne, about this right now, but that people who do this kind of breathing practice in the post-surgical environment, even in the ICU, you can do it in the bed in the ICU, and they require less pain medication, and they actually heal more rapidly.
There are some studies done at Mass General Hospitals focusing more on short pre-surgical hypnosis for, in hospital short procedures, and people who spend just a few minutes going to a place that's relaxing and follow a short induction into a more relaxed state tend to have quicker recovery time, tend to have less need for post-operative medication, and there also tends to be less adverse accidents and events during those. And those three improvements actually have huge economic benefits to the hospital ward. So people are starting to integrate some of these into procedures in the hospital.
Right, so it even benefits the doctor in the hospital, but the person who benefits the most, of course, is the patient.
Yes, yes. And going back to the breathing, so these are all the mental pieces, but I think as Dr. Guo was saying as well, there's some very obvious benefits to good breathing, and one is that as you learn to breathe, your gas exchange is more efficient, you're getting more oxygen into your body, you're massaging your physical body, you're moving your rib cage, and you're also getting rid of the the unwanted gases, the carbon dioxide and other compounds that build up, and then just that massage. And so I think there's a lot of really great benefits to breathing. I think it's something I would love to see be taught in kindergarten, if not sooner.
Well, they actually have these, what do they call, inhalation spirometers or something like that in the hospitals now. After you've had surgery, they make you do,
sure,
do this little device where you have to suck the bubble up but to a certain level or something. And really what it's doing is it's giving you a way of measuring how deeply you're breathing and how fully you're actually pushing the bad air out of your lungs.
That's right. And we use those technologies, actually more sophisticated ones, in our studies with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And we find that these people have, in our pilot study, which is just ending now, the preliminary data suggests that quality of life is changing, their ability to do exercise is changing, but also just how they react to an impending asthmatic attack or bronchial constriction event. Changes that they realize, okay, something's going to close up and I could panic, but we've given them some other tools about resting into their body, not necessarily breathing just the way they used to through their nose or mouth, but to give them other breathing techniques. And that seems to have given them a lot of relief and benefits.
So how does one get started? If you want to learn Tai Chi, do you have to go to a center, take a class? Can you do this with a video? What's the best way to get started?
I think it is always recommended to find a good teacher. And Tai Chi is like any other arts, and the instructor is very important. And your experiences, and especially first experiences, very much depending on the experiences of the instructor. And a lot of people try to learn Tai Chi, especially complicated Tai Chi movement, and through video. And of course, it helps them to understand Tai Chi movement, but oftentimes it also creates some problem, because there are a lot of things that in Tai Chi has to be experiential, personally, and experienced in terms of how the body moves and how you understand, grasp the concept. Oftentimes, that can be very foreign to you.
Right. I once took a beginner's Tai Chi class, and I think the whole, six classes or something, basically all we did was to learn how to stand.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of it is body mechanics and the ways your bones align and so forth, and that you can't learn really from a video.
Absolutely.
I think that's right. I think... I fully agree with Dr. Guo. I think finding a good teacher is really important. And I think my experience is that just like finding a good physician or any therapist, that's a very personal decision. And some people might be attracted to some kind of an approach versus other people to a different approach. So it's important, if people have the choice, to shop around. And often visiting a class or two will give you a feel for the types of people that are there, the social environment. And I think that it's like any exercise or practice that we're trying to do to improve ourselves. We can never get too much support to maintain that. So being part of a group, having teacher and colleagues or classmates to motivate you is great. Having said that, as Dr. Guo said, some people, just because of their physical limitations or because of their geographic or financial situation, may not have access. And so there are lots of resources on the internet, and I think in bookstores or other places where people can sort through them and maybe get some advice from other people. And I think one can make some progress with that. It wouldn't be optimal, but it would be far greater than nothing.
Right, and you mentioned that before surgery, even if you just have a few minutes worth of instruction, you can gain some benefit from it. So you don't have to go whole hog. You can get benefits just from learning how to do mindful breathing, right?
I think so. And I think as Dr. Guo and the protocol that he's developed shows, there's no one way to do Tai Chi. One can, if one has limitations in the lower extremities, one can do arm movements. You know, as long as they are taught in a thoughtful way and really embody the basic principles from this tradition, I think even little bits of it can be gained by anybody. And, you know, one doesn't necessarily practice piano to become a performer at Carnegie Hall. One can practice piano to be able to play a song or two. And people can learn Tai Chi just to gain some of the basic benefits. They don't necessarily need to become a champion or a master. So it just depends on what you're looking for. Certainly if you want to attain very high levels, then that would be something that's hard to do on your own. But certainly to get started, I think there are some resources out there.
Right, and we only have 4 minutes left. Is there anything particular that you want to leave with us? Dr. Guo, what would you recommend to people in how to get started?
Since we have been working with the people with disabilities, and my experience is that for the population, and the most important thing, and is not really for them to say completely recovery. Rather, is to establish confidence and looking for new hope in life. And so exercise and oftentimes will play their role and in creating self-confidence and increase their, you know, mental and physical health. And if there's anything that will able to help them to do that, I think that is fantastic.
I think that's really important point. And I would just, to build on that, to say that the goal of the philosophy of Tai Chi and Chinese medicine and these Eastern arts is sometimes less is more. The goal isn't to try your hardest and to achieve the greatest all at once, but to do things gradually and gently that honor what your limitations are. If you meet yourself at that point, then you'll make really good progress. And so as we teach in the hospitals and in our programs, we start with modest goals, just rocking back and forth, feeling your body, breathing, to feel the principles. The goal is not to learn complicated sequences necessarily at first, but just to draw essence from that, some very modest goals. And I think that's a great place for everyone to start.
Great. So mindful breathing and movement, and optimize what you can do. And Dr. Guo, you mentioned earlier that you have some people who began to look at their wheelchairs in a different light, too, that it wasn't a limitation anymore. It was more like a pair of dancing shoes.
Right, and this is a very, very powerful image. And when you watch those people doing Tai Chi, and immediately in your mind you see no wheelchairs, they all become powerful vehicle, and each one of them can move in so beautifully, and like ice skating shoes. And so when you have that and they're able to feel that, that really changes a lot of things and changes their self-perceptions about disability and changes their self-confidence and changes even their perceptions about themselves and the space.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate both of you being with us today. And next week we're going to hear from Dr. Sorman, who is a psychiatrist who lost his wife to ovarian cancer. And he talks about his experience as a spouse with her during her illness and recovering from her death. So I hope you'll be with us next week. And meanwhile, I hope that you'll try some Tai Chi practice, if only to do some mindful breathing, and have a great week, and be well, and be a powerful patient. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.